Join me in welcoming Professor Melman once more to ASU.
Thank you, Hava. It's a pleasure to be back, and it's a pleasure to see some faces that I even recognize from last fall, and I hope that I can keep your interest tonight and maybe take us a few steps farther than where I stopped last fall. When people think about the technologies that are emerging from the Human Genome Project, nothing scares us more than the prospect of using germline genetic engineering to control the future course of human evolution. Instead of evolution resulting from the operation of random genetic mutation and environmentally driven natural selection, it would be directed, or some fear misdirected, by human choice. Of course, as I noted in my talk last fall, we do many things already that interfere with the operation of random mutation and natural selection, such as selective breeding, this is a cotillion, now with computer assistance, match.com, also donor gametes, so this was the genius sperm bank that was in operation for a number of years to match Nobel laureate and other exceedingly attractive sperm to how is a sperm attractive? Well, sperm to eggs. Preimplantation genetic diagnosis. So now we can take an early stage embryo, extract a cell, run genetic tests on it, and discard the embryos because we make more than we need to implant. Discard the embryos that have undesirable genetic characteristics. Abortion is also a form of evolutionary directedness, if you will, because the fetuses that are aborted do not go on to reproduce. And also the treatment of persons with disabilities so that they survive and reproduce. This is also a major type of directed evolutionary technology. But what really scares people is germline genetic engineering, whereby we remove unwanted segments of DNA and add beneficial segments of DNA to a sufficiently early stage form of human life that the alterations that we make reoccur in the DNA of the person's offspring and their offspring and so on. And this is what really grabs our attention. For people who are worried about this, the worst-case scenario is nothing less than the destruction of the entire human species. This could happen, for example. And there are two main senses in which the human species could become extinct, or could be destroyed, I should say. One is in the literal sense. The human species would actually disappear. We would no longer be alive on this planet as a species. This could happen, for example, if people intent on producing children without genetic illnesses and with the same desirable genetic traits created children with the same genetic makeup. This would cause a loss of adaptivity, it is feared, so that we would not have the genetic variation that would enable some of us, at least, to survive a sudden severe environmental challenge. Similar to what can happen, we've already seen, with uniform genetically modified crops. As I said last fall, this concern about the loss of adaptivity seems to assume that non-directed evolution, the natural approach, would produce greater adaptivity. But this is not necessarily the case. Many changes produced by non-directed evolution are non-adaptive. And as we have seen, though fortunately not yet with our own species, entire randomly involved ecosystems can vanish relatively suddenly in response to dramatic environmental shifts. Then there is the opposite concern, that our species would not change enough, but that it would change too much, leading to divergent human subspecies or even new hominid species. Now, aside from making for some very weird sexual experiences, the problem here is that this risks creating, as Hava mentioned, a superior hominid species that could lord it over, enslave, and ultimately destroy the others. Of course, evolution is all about species change. So the fear is not so much that humanity would change, but that it would change too rapidly, too quickly. Well, even if directed evolution did not literally destroy humanity, another set of objections focuses on the nature of the humans that would result from directed evolution. As I mentioned last fall, commentators such as Leon Cass and Francis Fukuyama worry that they would become dehumanized or lose their human dignity or no longer know their rightful place in relation to God. One might be tempted to accuse these critics, and I sort of did this in the fall, of being obtuse or falling prey to the is-ought fallacy, you know, thinking that just because something means that it is the right thing, it ought to be. But I think these critics are trying to express a concern that is not only valid, but that goes to the heart of the matter. Why do we care about the survival of humanity in the first place? Part of the reason we care is that we are hardwired by our genes to be that way so that our genes can survive. That's true. But beyond that, our survival is necessary so that we can continue to have the conditions necessary to make cultural progress. And cultural progress, which includes scientific progress and the ability to use it wisely, is necessary in turn because that is how we come closer to solving the great enigma. So evolutionary change that prevents us from making cultural progress is indeed a serious threat. Ronald Dworkin put it best, I think, when he asked whether germline genetic engineering would unhinge morality. I think that's what he was getting at. Lately, legal scholars have busied themselves with how we should prepare against risks that were so dire that they threatened to destroy humanity. One of those scholars is Richard Posner, a former University of Chicago law professor, now a judge on the U.S. Seventh Circuit, also a polymath, and he's written a book called Catastrophe, Risk, and Response, which addresses this issue. Another law professor who's tackled this area is Cass Sunstein. He was a Harvard law professor, and he's now the director of the White House Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. He's written a book called Laws of Fear Beyond the Precautionary Principle and another that simply is titled Worst Case Scenarios. Now, Sunstein and Posner identify a number of potential catastrophes. For example, one that they both address is the Earth being struck by an asteroid. Posner suggests an interesting way of determining if we are taking sufficient precautions against such a catastrophe. He calls it inverse cost-benefit analysis. And what he does is he calculates the value of human extinction. So he actually, as a good Chicago school law and economics person, puts a monetary figure on the cost of destroying the human species. His figure is $600 trillion. That's not what we gave AIG last week, is it? No, I think. He bases this figure, by the way, on he calculates that the value of a human life is $50,000, which is an awfully low figure. And he doesn't count the losses of future generations. But anyway, using that estimate of $600 trillion, he then calculates how much we're spending every year to try to prevent asteroid collisions, mainly by charting threatening objects in space. And he calculates that at $10 million. And so if you divide one into the other, this translates to a perceived annual risk of about 1.7 in 100 million. And what he says we can do now is we can see if that strikes us as out of whack with what we think the chances of a major asteroid collision are. And if we think it's either too much or too little, then we can adjust our spending response to that. Well, similarly then, if we could figure out how much we're spending to prevent directed evolution and, like Posner, come up with some value for mankind, we could divide one into the other and generate a probability and see if we felt this was an adequate degree of protection. But directed evolution, unlike an asteroid strike, is not a random event. It's the result of human scientific endeavor. Of course, this is not the first time that we have worried about potentially catastrophic human scientific endeavors. For example, there were fears of this sort surrounding the Manhattan Project to create the atomic bomb. One of the physicists on that project, Edward Teller, who would become known as the father of the hydrogen bomb, was worried that an atomic explosion, such as the Trinity test, the test of the first atomic device out in the desert, could ignite the nitrogen in the atmosphere or the hydrogen in the oceans and burn up the world. Other scientists on the project examined Teller's worry and concluded that it was groundless because no matter how high the temperature, they said, energy loss would exceed energy production by a reasonable factor. Fears of catastrophe from big science also arose in connection with particle accelerators, starting with the Bevelack Collider at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory in the early 1970s, then going on to the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider at Brookhaven National Laboratory in the late 1990s, and most recently, the new Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Europe. Notice the size of the man in the bottom of that picture. Notice the relative large enlarging of this technology. The purpose of the Large Hadron Collider is to recreate the state of matter in the first few milliseconds after the Big Bang. And this has generated two major concerns about potential catastrophe. One is the production of strangelets. The idea is that the collisions in this collider would produce a shower of quarks that would include some strange quarks they would be so strange that contrary to the usual ones that are unstable, these would be stable enough to survive long enough, and if they were negatively charged, they could fuse with the nearby up and down quarks to produce a compressed object called a strangelet. And this, in turn, would fuse with other nearby matter until all matter was converted to a hyperdense sphere of strange matter 100 meters across. And that would be a catastrophe, right? Anybody read Cat's Cradle? Kurt Vonnegut? Sounds like Ice Nine to me, but anyway. The second worry is that this collider would inadvertently create a black hole which would swallow the Earth. Posner wants to rely on the power of law and public policy to prevent such catastrophes. The asteroid strike, the Large Hadron Collider doing this to us. And indeed, there was a lawsuit in Hawaii in an effort to try to stop the Large Hadron Collider project. This is the page from the law book where this case, Sancho versus the U.S. Department of Energy, is published. The case was dismissed by the judge for lack of jurisdiction, with the district court saying, interestingly, this is a policy, not a legal matter. Now, Posner is worried that the lawyers who, in his view, are sort of driving policy and certainly in charge of the courts, are not equipped to deal with these kinds of threats from big science. And he proposes a solution, and that is that in order to graduate from law school, all law students would have to demonstrate basic competence in a science. This is his solution. So perhaps, I guess the idea is if this judge, the judge in Hawaii, had a basic competence in the science involved, she would have been less squeamish about addressing the merits of the case. Well, here's the report commissioned by CERN to determine if the fears about the Large Hadron Collider were well-founded. This is addressing one of the fears, the black hole concern. The bulk of the report looks like this. And I showed this page to the chair of our physics department at Case Western Reserve University, and I asked him, would a law student who had taken a physics course in college be able to interpret and evaluate this? And if not, would a person who had graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Physics and then gone to law school be able to interpret this? And he said no. He said at a minimum it would take an advanced graduate student in theoretical physics to understand and judge these papers. So I think unless we want law students to all have that degree of scientific training, I think Posner's solution is rather naive. But there's another reason why Posner's approach to preventing catastrophe is not the best way to prevent harm from directed evolution, or at least it's not the first way that I think we ought to think about. And I first sensed this when I attended a workshop at the American Association for the Advancement of Science in 2006, and we gave papers on genetic enhancement. This is the publication from that conference. And one of the speakers at this conference was this fellow. His name is Mike Rocco. And he's the senior advisor for nanotechnology at the National Science Foundation. He's generally called, I think, the father of nanotechnology in this country. And he got up, and we had been talking about genetic enhancement, and he got up and talked about enhancement through nanotechnology and what our policy responses should be to the potential threats that that created. And I had the strangest sensation as he spoke, because he was using a language that was utterly foreign to me. At least as a bioethicist. And the reason was, I sort of began to figure out, was that he was an engineer, not a bioethicist, and that like Posner and Sunstein, he was approaching the concerns about nanotechnology as if he were a policymaker trying to decide whether to allow a big science project like CERN, like the Large Hadron Collider, to go forward. And here's a graph from his remarks. And if you look at it, you can sort of see some of the headings and so on, and it speaks in terms of management and assessment spheres and risk appraisal and management and judgments about whether the risks are tolerable and, if not, what measures are needed to reduce them. And this is a completely different approach from the language of from my language, the language of law and bioethics. A bioethicist would focus instead on the individuals who would be directly affected by directed evolutionary technologies. And he would ask, what benefits would they receive and what harms, at what price, in other words? Are these individuals capable of weighing the benefits and risks? And if so, what choices are they likely to make? And if they are not capable of making rational choices, how should decisions be made? Do these decisions create a risk of unacceptable harm to others? And if so, how and to what extent should they be limited? And here's how a bioethicist might assess the risk of genetic engineering and directed evolution. And it's a completely different, screen isn't large enough to put the two approaches side by side, but it's completely different language than the language that Mike Rocco was using. From a bioethical perspective, the primary emphasis should not be on the threats that the directed evolution poses to the survival of our species, but the harms to those who were actually genetically engineered in an effort to direct evolution. Who is that? The children. So let's consider directed evolution from their standpoint. What harms could they suffer? What could we do to our children? Some of these harms are intangible, such as treating them as commodities, depriving them of what Joel Feinberg calls an open future. If those effects would, in Dworkin's words again, unhinge morality and stop cultural progress, or slow it down, or reverse it, then they are indeed worth worrying about. Clearly, we should also worry about the potential tangible physical and mental harms from genetic engineering gone awry. I don't know why it's doing that, but. So how can we prevent this harm from occurring? We first have to identify the actors or pressure points where public intervention may be able to have an effect. The first set of pressure points are the researchers, both the investigators themselves and their sources of funding. But it's difficult, if not impossible, to stifle research, especially if we're talking about basic research. And we saw that even though the Bush administration strove mightily to stop embryonic stem cell research, it still went on with private money and state money. A more successful example, however, of an effort to stop research was the history of the recombinant DNA engineering development of recombinant DNA engineering. The inventor of this technology, or at least a fellow who's given much of the credit, is Paul Berg, Nobel laureate Paul Berg, and he based his original experiments on a virus called simian virus 40, which in 1960 had been found in monkey kidney cells that had been used to produce the Salk and Sabin polio vaccines in the 1950s, and which was relatively easy to work with. So this was one of his basic constituents. In 1961, however, researchers discovered that SV40 produced cancers in hamsters. I think hamsters in the wild. Are there hamsters in the wild? Oh, well. This led the U.S. government to screen all of our stocks of polio vaccines to make sure that they had not been contaminated with this simian SV40 virus. Nevertheless, Paul Berg decided to try to splice SV40 DNA into the DNA of E. coli, which is a bacterium that lives in our intestinal tracts and is necessary for us to, among other things, digest. And he was about to do this when a cancer researcher got wind of his planned experiment and said, "Paul, do you realize you might inadvertently create a new cancer-causing organism that would flourish in our intestinal tract and would be impossible to control?" He was stunned by this, by what he was about to do, and so he reacted by calling for a voluntary moratorium on recombinant DNA technology experimentation worldwide. And he got a bunch of his colleagues together, and they published this very famous letter in Science calling for a worldwide ban on rDNA research until we can get people together to think about how we should regulate this research so they don't do something foolish and dangerous. And it worked. From what we know, it worked. The research stopped. And it lasted for about 7 months until HEW convened a group of experts. Dr. Curtis isn't here tonight, I don't think, but he was one of them at this original meeting and went on to be one of the designers of the regulatory structure that we created to try make sure that this was done in a relatively safe manner. So it's possible, there is precedent for doing this, but only once. A second pressure point is the commercialization of these technologies. The developers and the distributors, the purveyors of this of these technologies, and some of these entities are regulated by, for example, the Food and Drug Administration. But it's not clear that the FDA has legislative authority to regulate directed evolution. The FDA has jurisdiction over products such as drugs, medical devices, biologics like vaccines, but not over the delivery of medical services. And germline genetic enhancement, which would be a major part of directed evolutionary efforts, might well be considered a medical service rather than a product. Now, Congress could give the FDA authority to regulate services as well as products, but they would come up against a very stiff opposition from organized medicine, the AMA, which has historically fought attempts to give the FDA jurisdiction to regulate the practice of medicine as opposed to regulating the technologies that are used in that practice. So it would be very difficult to do that politically. Now, many of the interventions used to direct evolution would be employed as part of assisted reproduction, in vitro fertilization, and the follow-on technological steps. And it's noteworthy how little state and federal regulation there is of that industry at this time. Now, Octomom may change this, but it's unlikely that we will go, certainly unlikely that we will go as far as they do in the United Kingdom, where an in vitro fertilization clinic cannot employ a specific genetic test to determine which embryos to implant after IVF, in other words, a specific test for pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, unless they get permission from the government, from the UK government, for that specific test. So very heavily regulated in the UK. I don't think we could bring ourselves to that degree of oversight in this country for reasons we can talk about later, if you like. What about physicians? A lot of these technologies will be mediated by physicians. They will serve as gatekeepers, not in the managed care sense of trying to avoid spending money, but as gatekeepers to the more exotic forms of directed evolutionary technology. Well, they're regulated by state medical boards, but it's unclear if under what circumstances, if any, the genetic engineering would be considered a violation of their professional responsibilities under their licensing statutes. Now, there's also some professional self-regulation here, and this was a policy statement put out by the AMA's Council on Ethical and Judicial Affairs. That's the entity within the American Medical Association that oversees its code of ethics, revises the code as necessary, and issues ethics opinions. And this was a policy statement they came out with, note the date, in 1994, on genetic enhancement. And it says, genetic interventions to enhance traits should be considered permissible only in severely restricted situations. There must be clear and meaningful benefit to the fetus or child, no trade-off with other characteristics or traits, and equal access irrespective of income or other socioeconomic characteristics. Very interesting. The first one and the third one sound good to me. The second one is a little troubling, right? So I guess they would say that a physician could not ethically allow a parent to alter, to genetically enhance their child if doing so would have any adverse effect, no matter how small, no matter how trivial. So you couldn't, for example, gain 20 IQ points if it would make you a quarter of an inch shorter. And that seems to me to be a little bit extreme. But anyway, this is an effort by them to govern their professional activities. Well, finally, to what extent can we exert pressure on what I think is the most important pressure point, and that is parents? Because after all, it's unlikely that, given the history of eugenics, of government mandated genetic interventions in this country, I think most of what will happen because parents ask for it to happen. They will be seeking these technologies. Now, our legal system gives parents a very wide latitude when it comes to their children, right? You can do an awful lot to your child and not get arrested, right? You can force them to do all kinds of things that certainly they don't like, right? Like playing a musical instrument, practicing every day after school. Parents can expose their children to relatively significant risks of relatively serious physical injury, like they can allow them to play dangerous sports, right? Gymnastics, football, and so on. Now, the primary legal constraint on parental decision-making for their children are state laws against child abuse and neglect. And these laws vary from state to state, but they generally say that they generally prohibit parents from creating, and this comes from the Ohio Abuse and Neglect Statute, from creating a substantial risk to the health or safety of the child by violating a duty of care, protection, or support. Now, some forms of directed evolution, such as interventions with a significant risk of creating monsters, or the performing of dangerous enhancement experiments on children without adequate animal and other human safety data, would undoubtedly be considered child abuse, and they would justify punishment, which would include criminal punishment and the taking the children away from the custody and decision-making authority of the parents. Now, in my opinion, and I've studied the laws of abuse and neglect as they might be applied in this area, and in my opinion, I think those laws are adequate, an adequate tool to do our job. That is, as interpreted and applied by the courts, I think it would furnish parents with a sufficient degree of freedom to direct evolution, while at the same time preventing undue harm to their offspring. Now, there are no existing cases in which this has been tested, but my instinct from what I've been able to research tells me that this tool could do the trick. But that only responds to the primary concern of bioethics. What risks and benefits and net harms are we imposing on our children? We can't lose sight of the larger question, if you will, that is the types of long-range harms or collective threats that Posner and Sunstein and Mike Rocco and Ronald Dworkin focus on. Now, one way to think about how their concerns might fit into this is to ask this question. Could parents make choices that created a significant evolutionary threat, but that would not be considered child abuse? In other words, is our abuse and neglect tool capable not only of preventing undue harm to identifiable child victims, but also from preventing more long-term threats to the species? Can you think of something parents could do that would not be considered child abuse, but that might pose a threat to long-term survival? Well, I think I can think of one. We know that some parents, especially in certain Asian cultures, select the sex of their children through techniques such as sperm sorting, in vitro fertilization and pre-implantation gender identification, and abortion. From the standpoint of the child, it's hard to argue that a conscious parental choice to produce a child of a particular gender would harm the child sufficiently to be considered child abuse. But if this practice became widespread enough, might it cause serious evolutionary disruptions in humans? If so, do we possess the tools to respond to that type of threat? from a legal standpoint, we would no longer be relying on abuse and neglect statutes because this would not be considered abuse or neglect. But instead, we would need to rely on our corpus of public health law. This is the law that the government wields under the Constitution in the exercise of its so-called police powers. How extensive is this power, is the power of the public health law? Well, in a 1905 case, Jacobson versus Massachusetts, the Supreme Court said, according to settled principles, the police power of a state must be held to embrace, at least, such reasonable regulations established directly by legislative enactment as will protect the public health and the public safety. Very broad formulation. So, in theory, I guess, the government could use its public health powers to prohibit directed evolutionary steps so long as these steps were deemed to threaten the public health and safety. And this might be deemed to extend to gender selection if it became so widespread that it threatened a serious evolutionary effect. And the powers that the public health authorities wield are indeed significant, right? They can invade privacy, as they did during the early stages of the AIDS epidemic. They have the power to quarantine and confine. You may remember the story of the American lawyer in Italy with a resistant form of TB. And they also can forcibly treat you, for example, for tuberculosis. They can require that police will pick you up and take you to get your drugs, force you to take them. Now, the Jacobson case dealt with immunization programs. The issue there was a smallpox vaccination program in Cambridge that Mr. Jacobson didn't want to get vaccinated under because he was afraid he would have an adverse physical reaction to the vaccine. And Cambridge, the police picked him up, put him in jail, fined him $5. Oh, they fined him $5 for not going forward with the immunization. He refused to pay the fine, so they put him in jail. And this went all the way to the Supreme Court, and you see what the Supreme Court said about it. The question is whether vaccination would be regarded the same way as reproduction, okay? Because reproductive decisions, such as sex selection of our children, is arguably a very different matter from a constitutional perspective. And arguably, we shouldn't look at the Jacobson case for this issue, for an insight into that. We should look at another case, Skinner versus Oklahoma. This was a 1942 decision that involved a state law that required a certain three-time criminals to be sterilized so they could not pass on their criminal genes to their children. Now, in Skinner, the Supreme Court recognized that there was a fundamental right to reproduce. That's where that right was first recognized by the court. And they stated that a state law that deprived someone of that right would be subject to a strict scrutiny test. This strict scrutiny of the classification which a state makes in a sterilization law is essential, said the court, Justice Douglas writing for the majority. Now, this strict scrutiny test requires that government action, first of all, be in furtherance of a compelling state interest, and arguably preserving the species would meet that test. It also has to be narrowly tailored to achieve its purpose, and it must use the least restrictive means for achieving it. And I think those restrictions, those limitations on the police power when it comes to controlling reproduction would significantly limit how far the government can go in exercising its public health powers to control directed evolutionary decisions by parents. Now, we might, if we thought that those police powers were not extensive enough, we could always amend the Constitution. We're all talking about the law within this framework of our current constitutional principles. But we could change the Constitution, you know, go through all of those steps. And we could give the government much greater power, I think, to control reproductive decision-making up to and even beyond the power that's exercised by the government in the United Kingdom. But, again, we must be careful not to sacrifice cultural progress merely to ensure the survival of the species as we know it. So, in conclusion, I think Gregory Stock got it right when he said that with directed evolution, humanity is, quote, moving out of its childhood and into a gawky, stumbling adolescence. As a parent of one-time adolescence, I know how much this stage of life is fraught with peril. But I also bear in mind Ronald Dworkin's words. Playing God is indeed playing with fire, But that is what we mortals have done since Prometheus, the patron saint of dangerous discovery. We play with fire and take the consequences because the alternative is cowardice in the face of the unknown. So I am fearful, but I am also hopeful because, again as a parent, I know that the outcome of adolescence sometimes can be quite wonderful. Thank you. Comments, objections? Yes. Is there the question was there's been a lot of interest at least in choosing genetic characteristics such as eye color, hair color, stature, and so on. Is there any regulation of that activity yet? Not in this country. Not that I know of. Anybody correct me if... Do you have a question or... Yes? Okay, so the question is, what is the role of the insurance industry in choices to genetically engineer the health characteristics of offspring, that sort of thing? I mean, well, first of all, you have to distinguish between genetic interventions that would be deemed enhancement interventions, which, like cosmetic surgery, are not paid for by health insurance. And then on the other hand, cosmetic interventions designed to prevent or mitigate the effects of genetic illnesses, which might be covered, although the preventive side is a bit sketchy in terms of our current health insurance coverage. But the insurance companies are going to be very much involved in our genomes because we're entering an era of what's called personalized genomic medicine. We're learning that one size does not fit most in terms of our medical interventions and our drugs. And so we need to be much more aware of the genetic differences between people in terms of how they respond to different medical interventions. So insurance companies will, as well as our caregivers, will be much more mindful of our genetic makeups. But I don't know that they will be, the interesting question, I guess, would be if somebody intentionally engineered some kind of genetic problem that would cost the insurance company a lot of money to take care of later, would insurance companies, sort of penalize, the parents, and could they deprive them of coverage or raise their rates? And the only example I can think of there are deaf parents who intentionally go through in vitro fertilization and they intentionally implant fetuses that have the deaf genes so that the offspring will also be deaf, on the theory that deaf children grow up and with deaf parents, it's a very good environment for bringing up children, better than hearing children with deaf parents. And I don't know if I don't know what insurance companies do, if anything, about that sort of decision. I don't know. I've not heard that they penalize those parents in any way in terms of refusing to provide health coverage for their children. Does anybody know anything about that? Do I have any experience with that? I've not heard that, but that would be a really interesting way of getting at your question. Yes. Why can't we produce children that long if we have the tools to live that long? I mean, the planet's not big enough. We'll go somewhere else. But I don't mean to be, I'm not being flip, but You know, there's some interesting experiments that have been done to extend the lifespan of lower forms of life, like fruit flies and flatworms or some kind of worm. And they do extreme forms of caloric restriction. I don't know if you're familiar with that experimental program. And some humans are doing it to themselves now. And this is extreme caloric restriction. We're not just talking about the diet I've been on for 60 years. But what they're doing is dropping their caloric intake to about 30 to 40% of normal. And we see with those fruit flies and other critters that when we do that, they live on average 30 to 40% longer. And what's interesting, though, is that they become sterile. And they only regain fertility, and they can regain fertility much later in life if you start feeding them better, right? And, of course, it makes perfect sense from a sort of baseline biological perspective because, you know, the fertility gods or, you know, whatever's the genes that are controlling that or whatever the enzymes are saying, well, my God, you know, we can't even feed the parents, so what's the point of having a child in this condition of terrible famine because the child will die, there's not enough food, so we will stop reproduction, delay it, until the famine is abated, and then once we have more food to eat, we can start having babies again. So it's conceivable if we started to be able to live that long, we might see a similar sort of slowdown in our reproduction, and maybe we could have children. You know, we would regain fertility much later. Hava. Why am I hopeful? Because we've done some pretty smart things, right? Yes, that's right. And so I'm not one of those sort of transhumanists who go into this saying this is, you know, clearly going to be one of the greatest benefits to humanity, and we're you know, this is clearly the right road to take, and we should do it relatively unfettered by attempts to sort of regulate it or control it. But on the other hand, you know, I am fairly confident that we have both the tools and the wisdom to be able to do this in a wise way. I'm truly hopeful. I'm an optimist. And I guess the alternative is to be a pessimist, but even as a pessimist, you're not going to be able to stop it. I mean, and I talked a little bit about that last time, and I talk more about it in the book I'm writing for this project and the one I've just finished on biomedical enhancement more generally, and that is it's not possible to stop this. Certainly not even in the UK can they stop this. All they can do is try to channel it, create incentives and disincentives, but it's still going to happen. We may slow it down, but we can't stop it. And, you know, slowing it down, I think I mentioned this in the fall, the problem is the frog in the pot, right? If we slow it down, we may turn around, wake up someday, and it's happened, because it's happened so incrementally that we haven't been aware of it. So there are dangers in going even very slowly. But I am an optimist. Yes? You mean the directed evolutionary? Oh, sure, that's right. You mean in like physical, mechanical engineering, or you mean in directed evolution, human engineering? Oh, sure, absolutely. And that's the fear, for example, of the loss of adaptivity, or the fear of a too rapid speciation, and, you know, making mistakes, making, you know, maladaptive or you know, mistakes. Okay, so this is really the argument about adaptivity, and that is we need enough genetic diversity so that we will be able to respond to unforeseen challenges, environmental challenges, and so on. I mean, I talked a little bit about this in the fall, and one of the comments that the sort of transhumanists make, responses that they make to that objection, is that, well, we'll be able to, you know, re-engineer our next generation so they will be able to meet that environmental challenge. The real question is, will we have the time to do that, or will the environmental challenge be so sudden and so extreme that the existing genetic, you know, the existing organisms will not survive? that we will not be able to do? Germline? Right. Well, and there's certainly, we can certainly affect their survival ability as adults with somatic interventions, whether they're at the genetic level or otherwise. So, you know, conceivably, as our technologies continue to advance, we will gain, gain greater greater abilities in all of those realms. But it's a crapshoot. I mean, it's a risk. No question about it. But then isn't life a crapshoot? Yes. If I understand your question, you may be asking a question that a fellow named John Gordon asked in Science a number of years ago, where he said all of this worry about genetic enhancement is silly because we're never going to be able to do enough of it to have a significant effect on the human gene pool itself. Is that? And your concern is, could we ever do enough of it that we would have a serious effect, and how would we know it? Okay, it's a very good question. It gets to a lot of the complexities of evolutionary biology, which is not, I'm not an evolutionary biologist, but as I understand it, the answer is yes. There are certainly conditions under which, these kinds of deliberate acts would be accelerated or would be decelerated, and conditions in which they would have much more significant, sudden, dire effects than other conditions, right? So, for example, in terms of speciation, there are conditions of species isolation where you might have a much faster effect of, producing a new subspecies, for example, or indeed a new entire species than under other sets of conditions. I mean, you're raising a really interesting question, which I've thought a lot about but don't really have an answer to, and that is, what's our canary in the mine here? How will we know when we have a serious problem on our hands? I think, in terms of, for example, something as presently possible as gender imbalance, I think we could begin to identify tipping points, if you will, where the gender imbalance was so severe that we at least had to make radical changes in our marriage rules. So we'd have to go to polygamy or, what's the opposite? Polyandry, right, in order to produce enough offspring. But and that has cultural implications. But there might be tipping points that were there might be even in that realm, numbers, variations that were very destructive, that you might not be able to overcome very easily. Yes. Could those who were not genetically enhanced be disadvantaged relatively to those who were? And what laws are in place or could be put into place to deal with that? Yeah, I spent a lot of time in my book Wonder Genes thinking of ways that you might be able to protect the unenhanced from that kind of discrimination or, you know, sort of second or third class citizenship. And I talked about things like handicapping the enhanced so that, you know, we do that, for example, with in certain sports, we handicap those who have greater natural talents. In handicap horse racing, we handicap those horses that are more successful. And I thought about that, and I thought about licensing the people who got enhancements so that, like doctors, they'd have to use their gifts for the benefit of others and things like that. And I thought those were really clever and good ideas. And then I thought about it a little bit more and said, no, those were really dumb, because in order to impose those kinds of sort of rebalances through the law, you have to know who's enhanced and who isn't. And if you want to see what that world looks like, you got to see the movie Gattaca, because that's what they were doing. They were making sure that they knew who had been enhanced and who hadn't been in that movie, so that the enhanced could retain their privileges and not have competition from the unenhanced. But even though we would be doing it for the opposite reason, I think we would not want to live in a society that was that where, you know, the government, the law, was that intrusive and knew when we enhanced ourselves and our children. So in my latest book, The Price of Perfection, I've argued that what we really have to do is make sure that we don't have that kind of wealth-based access to what are truly socially critical forms of enhancement. That is, you know, if somebody develops a pill that really gives you a significant boost in intelligence, it seems to me that we're going to have to regard that as a basic human right. I know we're a long way from that with regard to a lot of basic necessities like healthcare and so on, but I think we're going to, as we make what I hope is continued cultural progress, I think that's going to have to be one of the steps that we take. Yes. You mean, will we do it to lower forms of life first and see? Experimenting? Yeah, sure. I mean, we're doing. Well, we've bred, certainly with hybridization, and yeah, sure, we've done that with animals and then with plants. I mean, the whole domestication, you know, effort has been essentially genetic engineering of a fairly, you know, limited sort, but and we'll certainly, I mean, you know, one of the points I made was that we certainly would not want to allow people to experiment on, you know, embryos and fetuses and children through, you know, genetically re-engineer them, unless we were fairly confident that doing that in other animals was not going to be lethal or, you know, produce really undesirable effects. So we would do a lot of experimenting. Okay, so now we have the interesting question of the really, really bright monkey, right, that we genetically enhance to be very bright, and that's an issue that a lot of people are concerned about, and that is, you know, the sort of the human, non-human dividing line, and when do we cross that with, I mean, chimeras is one way we might cross that, but also by just, you know, sort of creating tremendously enhanced other forms of life. My sense is I don't think it's that serious a problem in terms of how we would cope with smart apes, but... But I think that's what we would do. Yes? That we want to make cultural progress, and because that will allow us to, I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm really, really curious at what's going on, right? What it's all about. And I think we all are. I mean, I think that's why we are in space. That's why we are doing a lot of what we are doing in science. I think that's why a lot of us do what we do in our lives. And I think that we want to be able to continue towards that eventual understanding. Yes. genetic islands in the sense of sort of separated genetic groups. So, that's kind of the, I mean, unless you're thinking about geographically separated genetic islands, but if you're thinking about all of us living in society with different forms of, you know, of humans around us, the law is the law of minorities. It's the law of discrimination. It's the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, but now we would have the Genetic Speciation Non-Discrimination Act or something like that. So the good news is that we are building a long history of coming to terms with different, you know, groups within, different populations within society and how to live successfully with diversity. And I hope that, you know, we'll have those, that knowledge will help us live with genetically diverse populations, should we have them. Yes. In other words, could we be fairly uninhibiting when it comes to basic research, but be much more watchful when it comes to the applications of that research? Well, that's certainly would make sense. You can't do that much, as I understand it. And scientists here, tell me if I'm wrong, but you can't do that much to stifle basic research in the sense that you can't say this is so dangerous before we even know what it's good for. I mean, an example would be: should we not have done the Human Genome Project? That's basic research, and look at all the things that it's made possible or may make possible, and all the worries that it. So okay, it's back. It's very, very hard if it's. If it's basic research, it's very hard to know what problems it could create down the road, and therefore it's really very difficult to do any wise regulation of it. Except, you know, we might be able to set some funding priorities and say we want to fund basic research that might cure diseases before we fund basic research that might yield enhancement technologies, for example. But I think you're right. I think our history as of regulation of medical technology has been focused on the application stage. And, you know, I think given the benefits that can come from these technologies, I don't think we want to stifle the basic research. I think that would be a big mistake. Nothing at all? It kind of depends on what you mean by basic research. Bench research, I mean, really at that level, I think probably not much at all. When you start talking about testing animals and running clinical experiments, if you're still calling that basic research, then I think we begin to get concerned about, you know, some of the ethics of it. Right, sleep, food, all kinds of basic things they would be able to do without. But that's not, I mean, that's well beyond basic research. Okay, so we're down at the level of we're trying to see if we can get bacteria that can digest cellulose that could live in the human gut and therefore cure starvation or help deal with starvation in parts of the world. And would we want to stop that just because we might also use it to create soldiers who could live on newspaper? I mean, I'm just wondering. I mean, yeah, it's so, because so many of these technologies have beneficial uses as well as potentially troubling uses. I think it becomes very dangerous or very, very difficult to control it at the level before we get to the uses themselves. That's my sense. Yes. Do we need more laws? I think. Oh no, that's no. No, what I said is I think we have some very useful tools, the tools of abuse and neglect and the tools of the public health law. They certainly could do, together with our regulatory system for regulating medical technologies, the products part as opposed to the service providing part, I think they certainly can do the job. In fact, they might, as this person was suggesting, they might even do the job too vigorously if we aren't careful. What we need that now is to understand what the practical application of those legal principles would be in specific situations where we identify threats of harm, things like that, and that work still has to be done. And it's hard to do it with very speculatively, but some people are trying to do that. Do we need whole different sets of laws? I don't think so. Well, there's something to be said for flexibility, as long as it isn't arbitrary. So I'm in favor of sort of general principles, and then trusting wise people like judges and juries and legislators to apply them. Oh, come on.
Yeah. On this.
They're not all lawyers. No? Wait, there's a... Yeah. Well, but if Posner has his way, we're all going to be lawyer scientists, so we'll be okay. Yes.
Last question, Mike.
You talk about laws, and you recognize that we're a nation that seems to function fairly well under laws, but we're also talking about something that has different ramifications and applications internationally. You might have restrictions here, or say, subject to parents, you might have a country.
What a great last question. One of the reasons that it's impossible to stop this progression completely is the fact that if you can't do it in this country, there will be a country that will allow you to do it because it will be they will feel it's in their interest to try to develop these technologies. And, if you remember the arms race and the space race, we can certainly envision a genetics race or an evolution race like this. And there are people like James Cannon who talk about this as the next big competitive effort international in the international global economy. Can we regulate it at an international level? Well, the problem is, George Annis proposed a treaty on human genetic engineering and cloning, and tried to get that through the UN or to the UN, and it didn't really get very far. Although the Council of Europe and have issued sort of collective judgments about genetic engineering in their area of the world, but I don't see that as being feasible for a couple of reasons. One is that I think our public international legal tools are not nearly developed well enough to enable us to do anything about it, unless we have some very clear, threat to humanity that would affect all of us in a dire way, or at least all the members of the Security Council equally. And yet it's some of those folks who are probably going to be in the forefront of trying to gain competitive advantage through these technologies. So I don't see that happening. And the other problem is that it's the engineering perspective again. No disrespect to the engineers here, but it's the idea that this is a big science project, and if the UN comes along and says, don't do it, we can stop it because it's a building in Europe where they're doing collider stuff, and we can just pull the plug. It doesn't work that way. The reason I went through that sort of array of technologies is some of them are pretty crude compared to others, but this stuff's going on and has been going on for a long time, and it's going to go on. And it's just the question of how much more sophisticated are we going to get. And there are ways of doing this that are almost impregnable to certainly international regulation, if not domestic regulation, and need to be sort of protected from that. So I just don't have much faith. I think the international, the international perspective is one where we're going to have to deal with it as we do with, you know, with weapons of mass destruction, and you know, with equal sort of iffy success.
Well, we are going to stop here, but continue this conversation upstairs in the reception. So please join me in thanking Professor Melman for a very stimulating.